We're going to begin by looking at the synoptic problem. If you had to define what you thought synoptic problem was based off of just those two words, what would you guess? What is this topic going to be discussing? So which ones would they be? If it's a problems or difficulties with the synoptic gospels, which gospels are we looking at? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And why are those the synoptic gospels? Because they sound similar. Because, if you know your Greek, the S-Y-N prefix is the same where we get the word synagogue, but it means together. So we have this togetherness of these three gospels that in some sense presents some sort of difficulty. And let's go ahead, and we've done this somewhat already, but let's go ahead and line out this togetherness. Okay? Matthew's gospel. There is about 58% of Matthew's gospel inside or contained in or overlapping with, that's the right word, overlapping with Mark and Luke. So you have Matthew's gospel and it overlaps with Mark and Luke 58% of the material. 58% of Matthew can be found in Mark and Luke. The statistic for Luke 41%. 41% of Luke can be found in Mark and Matthew. 41% of Luke can be found in Mark and Matthew. Do you guys remember the statistic for Mark? 95, yes. Total, 95% overlap, Matthew and Luke. Just Matthew is 92%. So Matthew alone, Mark has 92% in Matthew. But when you add Luke, it goes up to 95%. Throw another number up there, which means there's about 4.6% unique material in Mark's gospel that can't be found in Matthew and Luke. So what's the synoptic problem? Or what's the difficulty? What is the inquiry that the synoptic problem is looking at based on these statistics? Say it again. Maybe part of it's who's the original. Now, there's something that's assumed in that question. That there is original, that is assumed. But that also that if you find the original, that it says something about the other ones. That there's a dependency. That this overlap is not incidental. That it's not accidental. Remember we talked about this with plagiarism. If I found 41% of your paper in someone else's, what would I assume? You cheated. But if I found 95% of your paper in someone else's, it's not even a question. It's almost absurd. Obviously, there is a dependency. So whenever you're looking at the synoptic problem, the question they're trying to ask is, how did this dependency occur? Which one began? Which one borrowed from which one? Which gospel came first? Which one came last? Why this statistics? Why this number of overlap? Do you hear the question? So, we have multiple theories, and I'm letting you know right now, inside of your oral exam, what I will do is I will just simply hold up things like this, and I'll say, tell me what hypothesis this is, and you'll have to be able to do it. Okay, which you'll be able to, relax. The first hypothesis is called the Augustinian hypothesis. Augustinian hypothesis. Named after... Yeah, Augustine, or Augustine, as us Western Americans say it. The Augustinian hypothesis says Matthew is written first, then Mark, then Luke. How nice. That's delightful. First one is that he says Matthew's written first, then Mark, then Luke. As a matter of fact, let me read to you. From Augustine's Harmony of the Gospels 1.2.3, he says, "Now those four evangelists whose names have gained the most remarkable circulation over the whole world, and whose number has been fixed as four, are believed to have written in the order which follows, first Matthew, then Mark, thirdly Luke, lastly John." Now John, we don't even really need to plot up there. Why? Because John, what is his number? Do you remember that one? Ooh, close. 8%. 8% of John can be found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We don't need to plot John up here in this hypothesis, okay? Because John's 8%, I mean, you can pretty much find yourself overlapping with every document by 8%, okay? No matter what you're writing, virtually. That's over-exaggeration, but you get the point. He says that this is the order. This is Augustine. Now, I will say, we do take our historical questions that we're asking about document dependency, and we do superimpose it on this document, because Augustine also has different explanations of why the order of the Gospels, outside of just Matthew wrote first. For example, listen to what he says here. He says, "But as respects the task of composing the record of the Gospel, which is to be accepted as ordained by divine authority, there were only two belonging to the number of those whom the Lord chose before the Passover that obtained places, namely, the first and the last. For the first place in order was held by Matthew, and the last by John. And thus the two remaining, who did not belong to the number referred to, but who at the same time had become followers of the Christ, who spoke in these others, were supported on either side by the same, like sons who were to be embraced, and who in this way were set in the midst between these two." What did he just say? Did you guys catch that? First of all, what does he say about the outer two Gospels? Yes, they were a part of the disciples. And then how does he describe the inner two? They weren't, but they came to follow Jesus. But they are being supported or held up or embraced like sons by their outer fathers. So he gives another explanation, a more theological or even really a more poetic explanation of the order, not just chronology. It's that actually Matthew and John, the eyewitnesses, are embracing Mark and Luke, which is why they form an inclusio. So you see him doing different things besides just saying Matthew first, then Mark, then Luke. However, we do have a precedent of Matthew first, then Mark, then Luke in Augustine. Does that make sense? However, I'll be honest with you, I don't really like Augustine's view of Mark. I think he's a bit pejorative. I think he's a bit negative. This is what he says. He says, "Mark follows Matthew closely and looks like his attendant and abbreviator." I was like, bro, Mark's not his abbreviator. But it makes sense why he would say that. It is a lot, you would think that it's a lot easier to summarize something than to expand it. Therefore, if we have a shorter one, you could see it as an abbreviation of the previous. You're just going to summarize what it is I'm saying in your notes. It'd be weird if your notes were bigger and more extensive than what I'm saying, right? Because abbreviation is usually the step after. It's not usually where you begin and then we expand, okay? The problem is that whenever you look at Mark's parallel accounts with Matthew, they're not really abbreviating. If anything, they're giving more detail. And we'll look at that later. However, this is the Augustinian hypothesis. Okay? Matthew first, then Mark, and then Luke. But notice the arrows. Matthew and Mark are contributing to Luke, because that will be something that's challenged later. Okay? We'll talk about that when we get there. In the 18th, 19th century, a guy by the name of J.J. Griesbach, J.J. Griesbach, 18th, 19th century, preserves Matthean priority. What do I mean by Matthean priority? Matthew first, that's all it means. Preserves Matthean priority, but he inverts the other two. He argues that Matthew influences Luke, and both of them contribute to influence Mark. So the 18th, 19th century, J.J. Griesbach comes up with a new theory. And it's not like he fabricates it out of nowhere. It's based off of Clement of Alexandria, a quote of Clement of Alexandria in Eusebius' Ecclesiastical Histories, 6.14.1, in case you care. And it says this, "In the same volumes, Clement has found room for a tradition of the primitive authorities of the church regarding the order of the Gospels. It is this. He used to say that the earliest Gospels were those containing the genealogies." Well, which Gospels contain genealogies? Matthew and Luke. So he finds this quote in Clement of Alexandria, and he says, "I would suggest that actually we've got it wrong. Matthew is first, but it is not Mark second. It is Luke second, as Clement attests." And then he gives this evidence, which is pretty compelling, to be honest. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 16, the text says, when evening came. When evening came. That's what it says. Okay? Oh, geez. In Luke 4, parallel passage, Luke 4, it says, at sunset. So it's a parallel passage. You can see the parallel passage. Okay? He says, when evening came, he says, well, here it's at sunset. This is what Mark says. Mark 1, parallel passage, same one, says this. That evening after sunset, what did Mark's gospel do there? Took both of them. And Griesbach would point to passages like this, and he would say, see, Matthew, then Luke, contribute to Mark. Which is the reason why Matthew has when evening came, Luke has at sunset, and Mark has that evening after sunset. Makes sense. He, though, is also in some sense retaining the negative look of Mark. He's just an abbreviator. All he's doing is grabbing pieces from the mystery and smushing them together and giving you a Cliff Notes version of what Matthew and Luke give us more extensively. But that's Griesbach, 18th, 19th century. When we move into the 19th and 20th centuries, Mark in priority comes onto the scene, and that's actually where we're still at today in the 21st century. Mark in priority, that's the name of this theory, Mark in priority. If you had to guess, what would you guess that it looks like? Mark inspires what?
Matthew.
Now you say that with a question mark sound, although I agree with you, but it's because we don't know exactly what's second. However, Matthew before Luke is widely attested. Every one of the theories has Matthew before Luke in some way, shape, or form. But Mark here becomes the one that influences Matthew and Luke. And there are several reasons why people come to this conclusion, and they're actually not dumb. Mark in priority came about in the 19th, 20th, and is still dominant among scholars in the 21st century because of a couple of reasons. Number one, there is what they would call assumed knowledge in Matthew. That when you're reading Matthew's gospel, Matthew is able to assume that you have certain knowledge of certain events because Mark already has written about it. So let's give you an example or two. Mark chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. This is the healing of the paralytic. A very dramatic scene, okay? Mark says it like this. He says, a few days later, when Jesus again entered Capernaum, the people heard that he had come home. So many gathered that there was no room left, not even outside the door, and he preached the word to them. Some men came, bringing to him a paralytic carried by four of them. Since they could not get him to Jesus because of the crowd, they made an opening in the roof above Jesus, and after digging through it, lowered the mat the paralyzed man was lying on. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, son, your sins are forgiven, and you guys know the rest of the story. Right? Now that's Mark's account. Listen to Matthew. Matthew chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, same account. Jesus stepped into a boat, crossed over, and came to his own town. Some men brought to him a paralytic lying on a mat. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, take heart, son, your sins are forgiven. What does Matthew leave out? A lot. Like what? What does he leave out? Name of the town. Yeah, the whole digging through the roof and lowering him down. That's the reason why Jesus saw their faith to begin with. And Matthew's like, meh. You know the story. He lowers him down, and then he uses the account for his own purposes. As a matter of fact, in Matthew 9, he's in the middle of a string of 12 successive miracle accounts, just one after another, and that's one of them. But they would argue, Mark in priority argues, you see, Matthew assumes certain knowledge about certain events. He assumes it because Mark's already written about it. You see their logic. I'm not asking if you agree with them. I'm just saying, do you understand what they're saying? You also see, at times, they would say that Matthew seems to be corrected by Mark at times. Now again, I'm describing this theory, so just relax, okay? I have a different definition of correction than what they do, but But it's not for me to give you my definition right now. It's for me to talk about theirs. Matthew seems to be correcting Mark at times. And at times, honestly, there is an interesting shift. So for example, Mark chapter 6, verse 14, and Matthew chapter 14, verse 1. This is the beheading of John the Baptist. Yeah, Mark. Matthew seems to be correcting Mark, because Mark's written first. So they would say, Matthew then at times has to clean up what Mark wrote. And this example is the beheading of John the Baptist. So you have Mark chapter 6, verse 14. It says, King Herod heard about this, for Jesus' name had become well known. Okay, so people were asking about John the Baptist. And one of the things that it mentions is that King Herod had heard about this, for Jesus' name had become well known. Listen to what Matthew 14, 1 says. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus. What did he do? Shifted his title. Which technically, actually, Herod's title is more accurate as Tetrarch and not king. As a matter of fact, the title of king was being warred over by Herod the Great. This isn't Herod the Great, this is Herod Antipas. Herod the Great, his sons, where he divvied up his kingdom and gave it to them, they were warring over the title of king, but Rome refused to give it to any of them. So technically, Herod Antipas was not King Herod. He was Herod Tetrarch, the Tetrarch. He was one of the Tetrarchs. So you have Mark saying King Herod, which is, maybe that's what people referred to him on the streets. But according to Rome, he was not the king. He was a Tetrarch. And so Matthew comes along, so the theory goes. Matthew comes along and says, that's not exactly right, so let me just clean it up a bit. You see how this is making sense? Because, if I'm going to be arguing for their position, it would be weird that Matthew had Herod the Tetrarch and Mark saw that and goes, let's call him King Herod. It's a bit of a shift from something that is accurate to less accurate, as opposed to less accurate to more accurate. You see the theory, is this making sense? They also would suggest that Mark includes obscure stories that the others omit. That Mark has stories that, frankly, are just kind of weird. That it would be strange if Mark had Matthew's gospel and was like, you know, it would be really good to add here this story. Where the other ones would be like, no, that's a dumb story to have into it. And so maybe they cut it out. Let me give you an example. Mark 8, 22 through 26. This is kind of a weird one. It says, they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. And when he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people, but they look like trees walking around. In other words, the people were walking, but they were inverted. Jesus is like, all right. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him home saying, don't go into the village. So you have this like weird miracle. It's the two-stage miracle where Jesus is like, did it work? And the guy's like, not really. And Jesus is like, sorry. Did it work? Yeah, it's great. Okay, moving on. So Mark has this weird narrative right in the middle of, as we're getting ready to move into the last week. And the theory goes, it would make sense if Mark had this a part of the original document. But the reason why it is not found in Matthew and Luke is because they're going, how did that help anything? And so they would cut it out. But they would argue that it would be weird if Matthew didn't have that account and Mark goes, you know what would really pull things together? The miracle where Jesus had to zap him twice. So as the theory goes, Mark wrote it first because, and this is going to break their heart later, because they would say he is being more historically accurate. That'll break their heart big time at a certain point. But that Matthew, it's not that he was being historically inaccurate, it's just that he was omitting some of the obscure stories that clouded the point that Mark was trying to make. Okay? Do you understand why they came to this theory? I'm not asking if you agree with it. I'm asking, do you get it? Okay. G.M. Styler ends up writing this. He says, given Mark, it is easy to see why Matthew was written. Given Matthew, it is hard to see why Mark was needed at all. And that's really the dominant position of scholars today, is Mark in priority-ish. It's the dominant position as far as what comes first, but it's not really the dominant theory. Because even with mark and priority, while we have a lot of things that could be quote-unquote explained, there are still some major holes. Like, for example, what do we do with the similarities between Matthew and Luke? Specifically because whenever you dive deep into the similarities of Matthew and Luke, they're not as similar as you would expect for them to be in certain portions. So, for example, there are a couple of times where Matthew will, in a sense, make some sort of editorial comment to clarify the account that we find in Mark. But then Luke doesn't retain the editorial comment that Matthew makes that makes the whole passage more clear. So scholars, as they're looking at the comparisons between Matthew and Luke, some of them began to say, listen, they do have parallel accounts with each other, but we're not so sure that they actually depended on each other at all. In other words, they began to question whether or not this arrow even existed. That yes, Mark is influencing Matthew. Yes, Mark is influencing Luke. But we're not so sure that Matthew and Luke were influencing each other. However, there are still 250 verses that are in Matthew and in Luke, but are not in Mark. So now the new question becomes, well, where does the parallel material come if they're not relying on each other? Are you understanding how this progression went? Does this make sense? If these two are not relying on each other, then what do we do about their similar verses, the 250 verses that these two have that Mark doesn't? Answer comes in the two-source theory. The two-source theory. So this is another one of your little maps you're going to have to know. The two-source theory, which does this. You have Mark as a key source that is influencing both Matthew as well as Luke. But notice there's no arrow here now. And then there is a second source known as Q that is influencing Matthew as well as Luke. So Q becomes this document. Matter of fact, Q is for the German word Quelle, which means source. It's simply the source that is the 250 verses that Matthew and Luke share that is not found in Mark. But the reason why that this other source would need to be is because they're arguing that Matthew and Luke are not dependent upon each other. Hence, no arrow connects them. So you have two sources then that are being used to make up Matthew and two sources then that are being used to make up Luke. And what they envision about Q is that Q is a document of sayings. It's just sayings, no narrative, just sayings, just listed. Almost like a list of quotes that maybe a minister would come up and be using in their preaching. Almost like exactly what we found in the Gospel of Thomas. Right? Remember, I told you in the Gospel of Thomas that the fact that we have this document that is just a bunch of sayings was huge, huge for some gospel scholars. Matter of fact, when we found it, they want to take that gospel and push it back into the 40s as early as we can. Why? Because it is a list of sayings with no narrative. A list of sayings, exactly what they had envisioned with Q before they found the Gospel of Thomas. So when that comes, they're going, okay, this isn't Q. Gospel of Thomas isn't Q. But this is what Q would have been like. Now, we still have a problem. Sorry, this, gets a little more complicated. But we have a problem because Matthew still has material that's unique to Matthew and not to Luke or Mark. And Luke has material that is unique to Luke and not to Mark or Q, to Mark or Matthew. So they are using these two sources, but they still have material that is found only in them. Then comes the four-source theory. And this is the last one, so you can breathe. The four-source theory is simply adding an M and adding an L. M is unique material only found in Matthew. L is unique material only found in Luke. And now we have four sources that are utilized to develop Matthew and Luke. You have Mark and Q, as well as M and L. What is Mark? Mark is that huge 48% overlap, or 41% overlap stuff. What is Q? The 250 verses that are shared by just Matthew and Luke, but not Mark. What is M? The material only found in Matthew. What is L? The material only found in Luke. And where we are today is basically some version of the two-source, four-source theory is where most scholars are at. But that is shifting. That is changing. As a matter of fact, let me give you 3 minutes. No. That is changing, and we'll talk about how that's changing tomorrow. Love you guys. See you in the morning after I see you at chapel.